Good evening. It's good to see everybody tonight. I want to start with just a couple questions, ask you a couple questions to mull over in your mind tonight. First of all, in your opinion, what is the worst sin someone could commit? Think about that in your mind. What is the worst sin you think someone could commit? And then secondly, think about what would be the most minute sin someone could commit in your opinion. What would be something small, maybe insignificant sin-wise in your opinion? Give a few seconds for you to mull that over. Well, I tell you a little story. One day last week, I was lying in bed at night, as I often do, and I was trying to think about what to preach about and what I would get fired up about, what I would get real excited about, what I would get passionate about, what I thought would resonate well with everybody here. And then all of a sudden it hit me. Pickles. Anyone who knows me knows that I absolutely love pickles. They are so good and delicious. They go with everything. If you can't tell by my sarcasm, they're absolutely disgusting and I don't want anything to do with them. I hate pickles so much that when I go and order a hamburger, for example, I will specifically tell them to leave the pickles off of there. And if for some reason they put pickles on there by accident, I like normally to ask for a replacement burger, not because I want to be that guy or that I can't take the pickles off myself. But, you know, you ask for a replacement because there could be juice and pickle residue on there, and I can taste that still, even in the slightest bit. So if I'm at Griff's, for example, and I order a sandwich or a panini with chips and they put a pickle in the basket, normally I'll tell them, you know, leave the pickle out of the basket completely, lest it secrete on my chips, because I don't want that. So you can see, I don't like pickles. And let's be honest, I mean, they smell terrible, they're green, and they just straight up look nasty. I've done a lot of research in the last few days, and the Bible doesn't have much to say about pickles, believe it or not. But in trying to find a topic to preach on that's relevant, that we can maybe hopefully all gain from in the world in which we live today, I thought about pickles, and here's why. You can tell by my statements that and my actions too, clearly that I don't want anything to do with pickles at all, which raised the question in my mind one night, well, what else do I hate? What else do I not want anything to do with? What do other people hate and not want anything to do with? What does society hate? What does society not appreciate? As Christians, what are we supposed to hate? What are we not supposed to hate? And then came to the final question, which is the topic of the lesson tonight. What sin do you hate? That's kind of the final question that came in my mind. So I want to look at a few ways tonight in which we can be approaching sin, our attitude towards sin, and at the same time hopefully examining ourselves by asking some pointed questions maybe that will hopefully help us answer the question to each one of us, which sin do I hate? So that's our goal tonight, and I hope we can all gain something from our study that makes us stronger in our conflict against sin and our stand against sin. The first thing we have to do is recognize what sin is. And this is a quick point because most everyone here tonight can easily recognize that anything that goes against God's law and God's will would be considered sin. You know, Jesus pointed sin out to the people when he was here and when he roamed the earth. God gave his law directly in the Old Testament that outlined what his will was and what his law was and what sin was. And then in the first century, we have the recorded letters, the teachings that the apostles taught, who, again, were representatives of God. They were authoritative in their teaching and the delivering of God's will for the people back then. And, of course, that's what's been saved for us today, even in the form of the New Testament, which we're reading from. So we all have a book that tells us what sin is. We're not ignorant of those things. But many times, simply just recognizing what sin is and recognizing that we can find out what it is isn't the easy part. It gets harder because the first thing we have to do is hate sin all the time. After we recognize what sin is and what constitutes sin, we have to make it a priority to hate sin. We have to hate evil, just like pickles. In Psalm 97 in verse 10, it says, "Let those who love the Lord hate evil." Hate evil. "For he guards the lives of his faithful ones and delivers them from the hand of the wicked." We have to hate evil and hate sin at all times. Not when we're just with other Christians, not when we're out in public, but when we're alone as well. You know, you've probably heard, and it's been said, it's a popular quote, that the true test of a man's character is what he does when no one is watching. And maybe we hate sin publicly, and we do all we can to publicly avoid sin, stay away from it, only to run into its arms when we get home when no one's looking. And I think a classic example of that, which we've heard in the past, is the internet. you know, not only with things like websites and pictures and videos and piracy and things like that, but even services like Netflix can become tempting too. And a lot of the examples I'm going to use are probably a little bit more geared toward the younger crowd, but hopefully we can all make application from these things tonight as well. So there might be a TV series or a movie or something like that that looks appealing to us for its entertainment value, but because of its content, we take a stand against it publicly. We don't go to the movies and see that. We don't pay money to watch that. We don't watch it on TV. But then, as soon as it's on Netflix, or as soon as we can watch it in the privacy of our own home or our own bedroom, and no one has to know, that begs the question, do we still hate the evil then? Because temptations like lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye, or anything that could be contained in there that could lead to sin, do we still hate that? Do we denounce bad language, filthy language, nudity, the glorifying of sin outside the computer screen and the TV screen, but then rush home to watch critically acclaimed and five-star rated, you know, original programming with no ratings at all, or movies with bad ratings, just to see what all the talk is about, or to see how it can be, or how we can be entertained by it. And obviously that is just one very small example. But the bigger point is this. We can't be hypocritical, because sin is sin no matter who is watching or who we're around. We can't hate sin publicly to love sin privately. So we have to make sure that we're firing on all cylinders, if you will, to take a stand against sin and hate sin all the time, not just some of the time. In Romans 6 and verse 23, Paul tells us that the wages of sin is death. So if we fall into sin, we need to get out. We need to ask for support and vow to never go back to it. And that might be easier for people to help in that effort, or help us in that effort, if they see the sin that we're committing and they can approach us and help us with that. But if the sin is private, and if we're doing that in our own bedroom or when we're alone, it's hard for them to do that because they don't know what's going on. So it puts the responsibility upon us, upon you and upon me, to make a change in our own attitude towards sin, and to repent and to change our thinking toward those things and what we're doing. So it becomes a little bit more difficult when it's a private situation, because we're the only ones at this point that knows about it. But we don't want to forget what Luke writes in Luke chapter 8. Nothing is hidden that will not be made manifest, nor is anything secret that will not be known and come to light at some point. So whether public or private, the result of unrepentant sin is the same. It's death. So once we realize that we have to hate sin all the time and the consequences of sin, and we understand that in our mind, we might say, and it might be easy for us to say, you know what, I do hate sin all the time. I understand that there's a difference between public sin and private sin, and I recognize those things. However, because sin encompasses such a wide variety of aspects, much more than just public versus private, it might be easier said than done for us to truly hate all forms of sin. And that brings us to our next point. I think one of the biggest struggles we face is being what I like to call an equal opportunity sin hater. And that's because we as humans, I think, place perceived value, perceived importance on a lot of things. And we qualify things in different degrees based on their consequences, maybe based on our personal feelings toward those things, and even society's feelings toward those things. And that certainly is no different with sin. I asked you earlier, you know, to think of what you might consider to be the worst sin, or a major sin, or a small sin, a minute sin. And I'm sure some of you saw right through that question, realizing that everyone's answer is certainly going to be the same, or is not going to be the same. Sorry, it's going to be different. And that the answer to the question really doesn't matter, because to God, sin is sin, big or small. And you think of some examples that we read about in the Bible where sins may appear to be big or small to many, and the consequences may appear to be big and small. The first thing I think of is Moses. Moses didn't get to go into the promised land because he didn't give God the glory. To some, that might seem like a small punishment for maybe a small sin. He didn't give God the glory. He didn't give him the authority, the recognition, the obedience that he deserved. And because of that, he wasn't able to go into the promised land. Okay, small sin, maybe small punishment. But what about Uzzah? Uzzah was killed for simply trying to help. He was trying to help protect the ark when it was going to fall off. He was doing something in most people's minds that would be good, but it went against the law. And when we go against any part of the law, it's as if we're going against all of the law in its entirety. So now we have a little bit different example here. Now we have a huge punishment. Remember, he was killed for this, for what I'm sure many people would consider to be a very small sin to some. I mean, he was trying to help. And a similar situation with Ananias and Sapphira. They were trying to help the church with the sale of their land. And they just held back a little bit of money from that. It didn't really change anything. So they kind of told a small lie, a white lie maybe we might call that, in the process. But they too were killed for that. So it's clear that to God, the punishment doesn't have to fit the crime, as we might say today. We're on equal playing field with God because, again, sin is sin. And there are many other examples in the Bible too. You can think of David and his punishment for adultery and having a man killed. But I think we get the idea. So our struggle comes when we try to approach and respond to sin differently based on how we feel about it or how we might rate it in our minds, much like we think about crimes and their punishments today in the world in which we live. And it's extremely relevant, I think, because on one hand we have the world telling us that some things maybe aren't that bad, or maybe that they're not bad at all, even though we know the Bible says they're wrong and they're sinful. On the other hand, we have some Christians who might react to sin based on their feelings about a particular sin. They might consider one that isn't all that bad, or they might consider one that is really, really bad, a major sin, if you will, which means they might not always be consistent in their approach, even though we know the Bible says, again, that sin is sin. Everything wrong is sinful. It doesn't really matter. Now, a quick example of this, I think, would be divorce. I wasn't around in this time, but from what I've heard, divorce was not popular or talked about at all in the 50s and 60s in that time frame, inside the church and outside the church. You know, society recognized at that time that, like the Bible states, divorce was not an option for married couples, except under very certain and particular circumstances. But as time went on and as the years go on, divorce is more common. And today it's more common than ever, and most everyone, even inside the church, has probably been affected by or know somebody who has gone through a divorce. But in the 50s and 60s, that would have been such a taboo topic. That would have been a major sin, if you will. But now it's so common and accepted by the world today, probably to many younger Christians, I'm sure that's considered or not considered a major sin anymore, like it might be to some older Christians. That might be the norm for people today. Certainly today we don't see regular rallies against divorce. We don't really see debates or arguments about it on TV or on the news. And if we're living as proper Christians, we don't treat those who are divorced or in an unscriptural marriage or something like that any different than we might our next door neighbor, simply because of their sin. Even though everyone could clearly read what the Bible and what Jesus himself says about divorce. But now let's look at an extended example and maybe more relevant in our world today. And I want to spend a little bit more time on this one and use this kind of as a case study for this point. And that is homosexuality. The Bible makes it very clear that homosexual behavior is sinful, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And certainly there are those who will try to argue and reinterpret those things to justify their actions, just like people do with Jesus' teaching on divorce. But it's clear that that behavior is condemned, and now's not the time or place to go into all of that. However, today we have more and more influences trying to persuade us that homosexuality is not sinful. And if we claim that it is sinful, we're the actual sinners because we're taking away people's rights. We're singling them out for something they have no control over. We're judging other people. We're not loving our brother, as Christians are supposed to do. And the fact is that whether someone believes homosexual tendencies are something someone is born with, a product of their upbringing, a product of their environment, or a choice that they make, is really 100% irrelevant. Because the sin is homosexual behavior, not homosexual temptation. Temptation is not sin. And the same could be said for any other tendencies anybody would claim they've always had or might have been born with or decided to take part in, like alcoholism, kleptomania, violence, maybe an extreme or an inappropriate attraction to the opposite sex. I mean, you name it. Simply because you're tempted in those manners does not mean that you're sinning. And certainly because some people are tempted more in those situations than others does not mean that they're sinning. But giving in to those temptations and on those desires and acting on those things, that is what produces sin and that is wrong. And that's what we're talking about here, the sinful behavior. But it seems that many Christians, and I want to use that word accommodatively here, don't seem to treat some sins the same as others. And an example of this would be homosexual sin. It doesn't seem like a lot of Christians treat the homosexual sin the same way they would treat the sin of divorce, like we just talked about, or the sin of unscriptural marriage, or drunkenness, or theft, or violence, or lying, anything else, it seems. An example of this, maybe you've heard of this, a few years ago in the news, there was a bakery owned by a couple, a husband and wife, that claimed to be Christians, and they baked wedding cakes for their business. That was their job, that was their shop. And one day, a homosexual couple walked into their shop, requested a cake for their wedding or partnership, whatever it was at that time, and the owners refused, and they said they would not take their business for the sole reason the couple was homosexual, and they did not support that. So the homosexual couple then sued the bakery, gained lots of publicity. It was all over the news and in the papers and things. And because of the public outcry of this situation, the bakery was shut down and the owners were threatened and harassed. Some people would say they did the right thing. They stood up for what they believed in. They hated sin. And please listen very carefully to what I'm about to say next, because I want to be very clear and make it very clear that I'm not trying to judge the hearts of these owners of this bakery. I'm not saying that I know their hearts. I'm not saying that I agree or disagree with what they did. But what I do want to say is this. I don't disagree that, yes, they took a stand against homosexual marriage by not, you know, baking the cake for that event. But my next question would be, did they take the same stand, or do they take the same stand against any other sinful marriage? What about engaged couples who have no scriptural right to be married? What about any wedding that God wouldn't validate? What about baking a cake in support of an event where they might know in all likelihood there's going to be a lot of drunkenness and carousing? Were they all treated the same way and refused service, maybe? I think you see, hopefully you see where I'm going with this. And again, please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I know we all have lines and limits on what we consider to be endorsing people's behaviors, and we can't ask every question known to man when we're selling products and services to people and things like that. But what I am saying is this. If we're going to take a stand against sin, we have to take a stand against sin, not a sin. Solely because we feel more strongly about it, because of society, because we're repulsed by it, because we have personal feelings toward it, whatever it is. Because to the world, what can that look like? To me, it looks like that can come across as we might be biased sometimes, or judgmental. Or that we might pick and choose what sins we want to take a stand against publicly, and which ones we want to make a big deal over, and which ones we don't. When we don't treat and we don't hate sin equally and treat all people equally, meaning with the same concern for their soul and level of concern for them, it doesn't appear to be consistent, because it might not be. And you've heard the old saying years ago, our goal is to hate the sin and love the sinner, no matter what they're doing or what they have done. So what are some of the practical effects then of this when this happens? The effects of not being an equal opportunity sin hater, if you will. Well, I've heard Christians who have made comments like this, and maybe you've heard similar things too. I think homosexuality is the worst kind of sin there is. Or I think homosexuality is the worst sin in the world we face today. I've heard Christians who've made these same statements in a room full of Christians at church and Bible studies. And think about this. If somebody was in that room that was or had struggled with the temptation of, or maybe even participated in that behavior, and is maybe trying to do everything they can to stop it, do you think that person is going to feel comfortable seeking out the help and the support of their church family and their church friends if they think that people think that is the worst sin someone could ever commit? Do you think they could come forward, as we like to say, and ask for help? Would they be comfortable doing that? Or might it do the opposite? Might they feel like, I'm such a bad person, look at how this is terrible, and give up? What about somebody who's maybe gone through a divorce, or someone who's committed adultery and was trying to salvage the pieces of their marriage, and they hear other Christians talking about how cheating on your spouse is the worst sin ever, and there is no way I could stay married to somebody who would do that? What about somebody who was dealing with drunkenness or the temptation of alcohol, and they heard Christians say, that was the worst thing you could do, or that was a major sin? Something that they would never commit. I would never do that. That doesn't tempt me. Do you think that's going to create an environment that fosters and encourages people, Christians, to seek out the help of their church family with whatever sin or temptation they're dealing with? Certainly not. Because if we're rating sin, we can almost appear to be better than others, because we would never commit those kind of sins, we might say. However, everyone has sinned. We're all sinners. No one is exempt from that. No one is better than anybody else, so what difference does it make? So in review, not being an equal opportunity sin hater can do three things, in my mind. One, it can change the way, possibly, Christians are perceived in the world. Two, it can have an effect on local churches where members are publicly stating what sins they feel are worse than others, or offering their opinion on those things, or how they would never commit sins like that. And then third, it makes it easier for some to justify and commit sins that they might consider to be small sins, smaller sins. Not those major sins, small sins, maybe insignificant sins. And that leads us to the next point. The fact that we need to recognize the power of sin and avoid sinful opportunities and sinful influences. We've seen the dangers of classifying sins as our mind and sharing that, being major sins, minor sins, and not remembering that just sin is sin. Whether someone creates or commits a small sin or a major sin to us, in our minds, the fact remains everyone has sinned. It's sin, just like you and me. And yes, certainly, we're not negating the fact that there would be more physical consequences depending on how major or minor a sin is, physically speaking. But the Bible tells us that the wages of sin is death. Any sin, it's death. It doesn't matter if it's big or small. And when we fail to remember that, I think it's the perfect entry point for the devil to make small sins, what we might consider insignificant sins, look more appealing to us. And we may be willing to toe the line as it is and get as close to we can as the edge to sin, because those are small sins. I've already said that pickles are gross. You may or may not agree with me on that. If you don't, you're wrong. But think of any food that you can't stand and substitute it for pickles. It's easy when it's on our plate or served to us at a restaurant to say, no, get that out of here. I don't want that. I don't want to smell it. I don't want anything about that. Get it out of here. It's really easy for us to do that. And the same goes for what we might consider to be major sins or sins that don't tempt us in any way. It's easy for us to say, no, get that out of here. I don't want anything to do with that. For major sins, it might be hard as Christians, if you've grown up in the church, to relate to those kind of things, because maybe you were never involved in or exposed to or participated in those things habitually. Unlike maybe those that were converted from a life of where sin was maybe more habitual or maybe just part of their everyday life, and it's harder for them to get over those things. For me personally, it's hard for me to see how alcohol is appealing to some people, for example. I can't relate to that. And the same for homosexual temptation we spoke about earlier. That's hard for me to comprehend because that's not something I can relate to. However, that doesn't mean that I'm any better simply because those specific items don't affect me. There are other items that do affect me. And maybe some of those items that tempt me and don't tempt others, they feel are hard to relate to or inconceivable or major temptations, major sins and things like that. The fact is, we all have different tendencies and we all have different temptations. So in that vein, thinking along those lines, instead of pickles, let's consider this. Cheesecake. Cheesecake is not gross. In fact, it's the opposite of gross. I looked it up earlier. It's the opposite of gross. It looks good. It smells good. I want to be around it. It would be very hard for me to say, no, get that out of here. I don't want it to go away. I don't want it to leave. I want to be with it. And if I can't eat it, I certainly just want to look at it. I mean, I want to look at it right now and eat it. And you know what? Sin can be like that too. We're all tempted by something. John tells us in 1 John 2 that sin falls under, you know, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and/or the pride of life. And there are sins that are going to appeal to all of us. And some of them are going to be like cheesecake. They look good. They smell good. We want to partake of them. And some are going to look like pickles. And it's much harder to say no thanks to the pickles and much harder to say no thanks to the cheesecake. It's just they're on different levels with us individually. And sometimes when we classify things as small sins, maybe just a little lie, a little untruth, a little jealousy, a little bad language, you get the idea. But the Bible has a lot to say about the power of sin. I'm going to throw a lot of verses on the screen here, so bear with me, I'll just put them on the screen here. Psalm 119 says, "Direct my footsteps according to your word. Let no sin rule over me." Sin has the power to rule over us, even small sins. Proverbs 5 and verse 22 says, "The evil deeds of a wicked man ensnare him. The cords of his sin hold him fast." Jesus says in John 8, "I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." Sin can enslave us. If you've got your Bibles, turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 7. We'll turn to this passage and look at this. Deuteronomy 7. Of course, this is in the Old Testament. And this is a warning given to the people regarding idols, which were sinful. And I think we can make an analogy from this today, using it as an example of sin in general. We can kind of use it as a placeholder and swap out the idols for sin in general. So look at Deuteronomy 7 in verse 25 and 26. It says, "The carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is in them, or take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. And you shall not bring an abominable thing into your house and become devoted to destruction like it. You shall utterly detest and abhor it, for it is devoted to destruction." We have to stay away from sin at all costs because it can have an effect on us. And because of that, it's important, I think, to recognize the power of sin and sin's deception. There's a reason why we shouldn't be around it. You know, when it comes to things like murder or adultery or something that we might say, is a black and white sin as recorded in the Bible, it's easy to say with certainty when those kind of sins have been committed. But what about sins like gossip? Think about that. Or untruths. Or fits of anger. Or refraining our tongues from evil. Those might not be as black and white as we might think in some other situations. And furthermore, some of those might be small sins to us or to many. And I think that's when things can get dangerous. Dangerous because sometimes we're willing to step as close as possible to the line on those things, even though we might not know exactly where the line begins. So there may be Christians who, just thinking of some examples, maybe publicly will drink alcohol, but they'll do that as long as they don't get drunk. There might be those who are willing to talk about others behind people's backs as long as they're convinced it's not gossip in their minds. There might be those who use sound-alike words to communicate bad and filthy language as long as it's not the real word or phrase from their tongue. It just sounds like it is. Why would people do any of these things? Maybe they're forgetting the power and the deceptiveness of sin. Because if sin is like pickles, we want it out of here. We want nothing to do with it. We don't want to be anywhere near it. We don't want it leaking into our other food, as it were. Paul says that we need to abstain from every form of evil in 1 Thessalonians. And some translations render that from all appearances of evil, because the Greek word could also be defined as appearance there. And then he also says in 2 Timothy 2 that we are to flee youthful passions and instead pursue righteousness. Those are on opposite ends of the spectrum. You leave this, you flee this, and pursue this. We're not anywhere near each other. They're come total opposites. We've got to get away from those things. But if we're keeping sin close by, if we're towing the line, if you will, don't you think at some point you're more willing to step over the line and actually fall into sin? And that's just what the devil wants, for us to think we're safe, for us to fall right into his trap. But it's hard when something looks so good, it looks so appealing, like cheesecake. Or when everyone else is doing it, or when we ask, you know, what's the harm in this? I'm not sinning, but sin is close by. And at some point, that cheesecake is going to look just too good not to eat. But we need to get the cheesecake out of here. And we need to get away from small sins and behavior that toes the line, because God determines where that line is. And we could be in sin when we think we're safe on the other side, for all we know. And that leads us to the final point regarding our approach and our attitude towards sin. And that is, we need to make a conscious effort to be pure and holy ourselves. We are not to be like the world. We're not to participate in the sins of the world or to be associated with them. And when we toe the line on sin, not only are we more tempted to possibly commit those sins, as we just talked about, but we can also give an impression to the world and to other Christians that we're almost passively accepting of sinful behavior by not showing a firm stand against it, by not fleeing from it, as Paul said. Being holy and set apart means it should be obvious to the world and to our brothers and our sisters that we are living different. We're trying to live different and not trying to fit in or go anywhere near sin. So look at those same examples we've kind of used earlier in the lesson tonight. If we're at a party and everyone's drinking and we're drinking alcohol too, but we make sure we don't get drunk because we know drunkenness is sinful, does it look like we're holy and set apart to anyone else at that party or any other bystander that might walk by? Or would they just assume that we're in agreement with everything that's going on at that event, including the drunkenness of others or maybe even worse? What about if we're coming out of a movie theater, a movie show that is full of language, nudity, that condones and many times praises sinful behavior, and you paid money out of your wallet to watch that? What about listening to music that's unedited all the time, filled with bad language, but we would claim we won't use that sinful language? Would everyone automatically assume that you take a stand like that against those kind of sins? Or would they assume the opposite, that you're fine with those things because the vast amount of language or alcohol or other sinful behavior you might surround yourself with? It certainly gives that impression. We're familiar with the words of Paul that says, "Bad company corrupts good morals," in 1 Corinthians. Our purity and our holiness can be ruined when we're with bad company and certainly around bad surroundings. Look what Peter says in 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2:12, he says, "Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." We need to keep our behavior honorable so that no one accuses us of sinning or endorsing sin in any way, accepting of any kind of sin, because they're all around us and we put ourselves in those situations. And like I said, those are just some examples. What about other cases you might have felt that you were in and you didn't sin? And maybe you didn't. But what if somebody saw you, a Christian, somebody claiming to represent Jesus, participating in things or surrounding yourself with sinful things? And maybe they look to you as an example. Maybe even somebody who represents the family here and what we stand for. And because of your actions, they too started to participate in some of those things or surround themselves with similar things. But this time, they did it to the point of sin. Because for all they knew, based on your appearance, they might have come to the conclusion that it must be okay. Even if before they thought it might have been sinful, or if maybe they were just unsure. But if they can rationalize and say, "Well, he's doing that, it must be okay. I look up to him. He's a Christian. He's trying to do the right thing." Or maybe they think, you know, it's one of those small sins. It's one of those insignificant things that maybe everybody does, and it's no big deal. You see, we can put others in danger when we're not trying to be set apart and holy, especially to newer Christians, and especially to weaker ones. And Jesus says that's a very bad thing. Turn with me to Matthew 18. Matthew 18, and we'll look at verses 4 through 6. Here the disciples have asked Jesus who the greatest in the kingdom is, and Jesus calls over a child to them and tells them they need to become like children. And in verse 4 of Matthew chapter 18, he says, "Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have had a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world for temptation to sin." Like Jesus said to his disciples, we don't want to cause anyone who believes in him to sin. That would be bad. And not everybody might be able to relate to the specific examples, as I've said again tonight, but to younger people, I think these kind of situations will really define who you are. Whether you are somebody that's looked at as being set apart, someone who's trying to be holy, someone who's different from the world, someone who recognizes that all sin is wrong. If you're around sin all the time on purpose, you're losing your godly influence. And don't be fooled. People of the world pick up on that. They take note of those kind of things. And when you see other Christians that appear to be towing the line, playing with fire, as it is, being a bad influence, maybe even in just your opinion, you know, and you feel like you can't confront them because you don't have black and white sins that you can say they've committed or something like that that we've talked about before, you can still be their friend and you can still show concern and express to them that you care enough about them that you don't want them to fall into greater temptation or into sin. And that you're concerned that maybe their behavior, maybe their actions or whatever it is could cause others to stumble. And we want to be pure and holy and we want to have that kind of influence to everyone and do nothing that would cause anyone to question our stand against sin and our efforts to remain pure and holy. And then for the rest of us, we need to remember to respect and sincerely appreciate people who do that. People who come to us out of concern and not get mad or upset about those things, that they're willing to express their concern with us, which might save our soul from death if they do that with the right attitude and the right purpose. We're familiar with James, who says, "He who turns a sinner from the error of his ways will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." And we shouldn't take that lightly. We could be saved by someone confronting us and sharing their concerns with us so that we might be able to see things clear, that we might be able to see what we're doing wrong, and then we might be able to stop towing the line on sin. So we end with the same question we started with tonight. Which sin do you hate? Hopefully your answer is all of them, big or small. Because we need to first recognize what sin is. We need to hate it all the time, publicly, privately, it doesn't matter. We need to be an equal opportunity sin hater and not treat certain sins certain ways just because of our feelings toward them. We need to recognize sin's power and its influence, even for small sins. That's a perfect opportunity to commit them when we think those are the insignificant ones. And we need to strive to be holy and set apart so we don't have a bad influence on other Christians in the world around us. Hopefully, we will treat all sin as equal and not treat certain sins or sinners based on how we personally rank their sin or how society ranks their sin. And hopefully, we'll remember our goal. Our goal is to save souls. Not to scare them away by offering our opinion on the magnitude of their sin or the fact that we could never relate to their sin or imagine committing their sin ourselves. Hopefully we won't judge and treat others differently because of the particular sins they've committed or the temptations they simply experience, because none of that matters. And then hopefully when we leave here tonight, we'll remember who we are and the fact that we represent our King and that we take a stand against sin. And furthermore, that we're to be holy, to be set apart from the world and give no one the impression that we approve or condone of any form or fashion of sin, big or small. And towing the line, it's not wise. We're playing with fire and could cause ourselves and others to stumble. And we certainly don't want to be responsible for either of those. And finally, always remember and think of sin as pickles. They're gross. Get them off my plate. Get them out of here. Even if sin looks just as good as cheesecake, we can't be fooled. The cheesecake, for all we know, could be pickle-flavored. We don't know. Until it's too late. Until you partake of it. Until you eat it. Because all sin leads to death. And we have to remember that. Sin here is the enemy. It's deceptive. It's out to destroy us. We want nothing to do with it. We can't be complacent about it. And sometimes we might not think as seriously about it as we should. Well, I thank you for your attention tonight. Hopefully you were able to gain something from the lesson tonight you can maybe take home in your fight against sin, helping others with sin and temptation. And if you know what you need to do tonight to become a Christian, or you just want to learn more about what it takes to become a Christian, there are men here who are more than willing to talk with you and help you and help you in that endeavor. Maybe you've sinned. Maybe you've not been treating sin as you should. Maybe even to the point of giving the world the wrong impression or giving other Christians the wrong impression. And maybe you want the help and the support of the family here to help you become more set apart, more holy. And again, we'd love to help you. We'd love to pray with you and help you in any way. Sins, big or small, temptations, major or minor, whatever it is. If we can help you in any way, come forward as we stand and sing.